and welcome to OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
A new podcast bringing to you the voices and ideas
of open educators from around the world.
OEG Voices is
produced by Open Education Global,
a member-based
nonprofit organization
supporting the development and use
of open education globally.
Learn more about us
at oeglobal.org.
There's much to take in at a global level.
We hope to bring you closer
to how open education is working
by hearing the stories of practitioners
told in their own voices.
Each episode introduces you
to a global open educator,
and we invite you to later engage in conversation with them
in our OEG Connect community.
Welcome to this new episode of OEG Voices, and I'm your host for this one, Alan Levine from Open Education Global, here with my colleagues Marcel Morales and Paul Stacey. Good day to you both. How are things in your neck of the woods?
All good here. Excited to be here with you guys.
Yes, all good for me too. Great to see Wayne again.
Yeah, and we're starting the announcement over the next few weeks for the winners of the 2021 Open Education Awards for Excellence. Sort of a new program. Usually they were announced at once, but we're going to be sort of doing it as a serial event. And so we're continuing in a quest we started last year to bring you the voices and stories of past year winners to highlight their work. And, of course, we're very pleased today to be talking today with Wayne McIntosh, from way down on the South Island of New Zealand, which excites me because we're going to get a good pin on the map in an area where we don't have one. And Wayne was recognized in 2020 with a really important Open Education Award in leadership for all the work he does as a UNESCO chair in OER and director of the OER Foundation and OER coordinator and creating things at Wiki Educator. And from my own experience of knowing Wayne a long time, there's even more than we probably all know about. So, and leadership in open education and even what it means to be considered a global open educator are topics of interest for me at OE Global. And we're just really more excited to have this conversation with Wayne. So welcome, Wayne. How's it feel to be in the studio?
Oh, it's wonderful, and thanks for the invitation, and it's great to see old colleagues again. I'm very pleased that you're going to get a pin on the map. One of the things that you need to check very carefully is that the map that you're using actually has New Zealand on it, because there is another organization in the open world that is heavily involved with licensing who would repeatedly publish global reports without New Zealand on the map. So I'm counting on you to get that right.
You can count on us, Wayne. I will triple check that. And so obviously Wayne has a lot of pride about New Zealand. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the work you do and what it means to be in this part of the world?
Sure. So I'm based in a small town called Cromwell, which is in central Otago. It's in the deep south of the South Island. And I live very close to the mountains. I'm roughly about 80 kilometers from Queenstown. So we're very fortunate to be living in a very beautiful part of the world. I love New Zealand. We've been here for almost 20 years now. But, you know, it's a great place to be, and, thanks to the affordances of the internet, I have the privilege of being able to work globally from, a very small abode here in Cromwell.
I know, and we certainly wish we could see, like, your backyard, because that is, I've been to some of that area. It's breathtaking, that terrain, and and always when I know I talk to you, you have so much pride and love for this place you are in the world. So this work that you do from Cromwell, if you give that like compact, explanation to, someone maybe outside of the realm of open education, how do you sort of encapsulate all you do into sort of like a nice snippy snippet?
Good question. And I'm very pleased that you didn't use the concept of, the elevator pitch. Because it's, you know, it's interesting how we in open education so often co-opt the language of the business world, right? And the notion of the elevator pitch is, you know, really this succinct description, you know, you in front of a bunch of angel investors and tell us what you do within a, you know, in a minute, otherwise we're not going to give you money. I kind of sort of preface that because working in open, what we do is, you know, we give stuff away. we don't market stuff. We're not out trying to get the next investment from the corporate world in terms of what we're doing. So this is, you know, it's just a preface and a caveat to say I don't think my elevator pitch is going to be that good. because we're not good at marketing, you know. As I said, we're very good at sharing. But I guess if I had to try and summarize what it is we do at the OER Foundation, you know, I would say this: we are trying to open source education, and the reason being that OER or open educational resources are a renewable and a sustainable resource, and that's kind of what we try to do in everything we do. And as you well know, we're a radically open organization. Everything we do is open. From A to Z is entirely open. And so, for example, as a matter of policy of the company, we're a registered company whose activities are restricted to charitable education activities. So that means, in fact, we can never sell off and become corporate. In terms of, you know, the constitution of our organization. But one of our policies is we are committed to the use of free and open source software in everything we do. In fact, staff members are not permitted to use any proprietary software in what we do. And that kind of gives us a unique perspective on life because, you know, delivering education open on online education based entirely on free and open source software gives us a unique perspective. I'm not aware of many organizations in the world that are actually entirely open in this radical sense. And radical not in the sense of revolution, but radical in the sense of radix, the core, the essence of what we're trying to do. And that's been, you know, an interesting journey. I mean, another great New Zealander, you've got to throw in a couple of big names. Ernst Rutherford, we like to claim ownership of Lord Ernst Rutherford, who is attributed to the work of around splitting the atom. And when he asked about the levels of innovation that take place in New Zealand, and this is a compliment to my counterparts who live here in Aotearoa, you can hear from my delightful Kiwi accent that this, you know, was not my birth country. But New Zealanders have an exceptionally high rate of innovation. And when Rutherford was asked this question, he replied, we don't have money. So we've got to think. And a lot of that kind of sort of number eight wire sort of mentality in the Kiwi analogy, you know, you can fix anything with a piece of eight gauge wire, has directed a lot of what we do. We don't have money. We eke out a meager existence trying to keep everything afloat. So we've had to think about, you know, how do you assemble a global ecosystem for delivery of free and open online courses based entirely on free and open source software. So it's kind of been the journey, and we're getting somewhere, but we've still got a long way to go.
Well, your commitment to this has been fierce as long as I know you, and we definitely respect you for that, because I'm sure it's not easy, but you've definitely proven that it can be done. And so as a journey, like what kind of set you out on this road? What was your entree into approaching education from this perspective?
An interesting pathway in terms of getting to where I am now around this radical openness. I originally trained as an accountant, although I don't readily admit that. And I figured after, you know, doing articles that this is not a career I can do for the next 40 years of my life. And I changed to education. And I trained as a secondary school teacher and went through that. Best decision I ever made. You know, classic training and face-to-face teaching. And then my first academic position was with the University of South Africa, which, as you will well be aware, was in fact the world's first single mode distance teaching university. And that triggered my interest in the open model. So traditional face-to-face teacher, here I'm working with this mega institution that is delivering all its education through technology mediated means. And that sparked the interest, the removal of barriers. How do you achieve high quality learning when you're not meeting synchronously? And then I delved into, all the theoretical development in the field. And then in the late 90s, recognized in the developing world, if we were going to make progress in achieving the philosophy and vision of, open learning, it would need to be through open source technologies. And so in the early days, I was a big fan of, enterprise level open technologies, open source technologies. And I was invited, or it would have been the early 2000s, there was a big conference or get together of open source developers in relation to a project we were working on at the time, the EXE editor, which was an open source editor to repackage content for learning management systems. And I had to give a presentation then. But, big convert in terms of enterprise level technologies, but still, running a bit of closed stuff on my box. But I was well behaved. And back in the day, this was before the days of LibreOffice, I had my open office presentation running in open office. So the audience, they could see, oh, it's open office. This is pretty neat. And there was a power failure, and then they had to reboot the systems. And I had to live the most embarrassing moment of my life, which was in front of this geek audience, I'm running a proprietary box. And that was the day I decided I cannot continue on this path. And, convert. But, it's an interesting journey. There's a lot of awareness that needs to be raised. When I was a lot younger, you tend to be a bit a tad more radical. And so if I was sending somebody an attachment, what I would always do, and this is also about respecting the choices of others, right? Which I think is very important. So what I would do is when I would send an attachment, I would send an ODT as well as a DocX. So I go to the trouble converter to DocX, but I would always put the ODT first in the list of attachments. And of course, what would happen, an unsuspecting user would click on the ODT and then they can't open the file. And it's kind of a conversation starter.
Yeah.
But I kind of don't do that stuff anymore. I always take the trouble to, if I know the user is using a proprietary tool, to convert it into a format that they can open and access that document. What frustrates me is when I'm not afforded those same respects. I will get a request to, join this big strategic discussion on open education, and then it's Microsoft Teams. And I'm sure it's totally unintentional, but what folk don't realize is that requires me to download proprietary software in order to connect to a meeting that you want me to join. It's the equivalent of, you invite me to your boardroom to come and chat about things open, and I get to the boardroom door and it's locked, and I knock on the door. I can hear people inside the room, but they won't let me in.
people you know, and they kind of
know that you're vegan, right? But they've got this all meat buffet.
Oh, I love the metaphors there. So everybody listening can get a feel for how Wayne operates. But maybe we should just, so people understand sort of the kind of work that the OER Foundation does, and maybe if you can touch on some of the highlights, or even, you know, I'd like to hear you talk about your most recent project. But just to get a sense about the way that here we are in Cromwell, that you're able to make an impact on the world. And obviously not just you, because you do have a team, but maybe to hear a little bit about OER Foundation.
So I set up the foundation, would have been 2009. I just left my contract at the Commonwealth of Learning. And the key challenge we were trying to address was to widen affordable access to post-secondary education for the millions of learners who were qualified for a seat in tertiary education, to use OPEN as a solution to address that challenge. And so one of the big advantages of, you know, courses that are assembled entirely from open educational resources and designed for high quality independent study is that the marginal cost of replication of those course materials is effectively zero. And so if you start thinking of a university learning experience, you can put together a disaggregated service provision model where you provide access to the learning materials entirely free. You design for high quality independent studies. So there are aspects of learner support that can be given for free. The only piece that would require funding for sustainability would be to provide assessment services for formal academic credit. And so that is the concept that we put together in establishing the OER Universitas, or the OERU for short. And the interesting stories around this, we had our initial founding meeting would have been in 20 when would that have been, Paul, you were at the first meeting.
I know, I was just thinking
a while ago.
22nd of February 2011, and the reason I can remember it was the day of the Christchurch earthquakes. And which was interesting, the Christchurch Airport is a hub for people to connect, to come down to Dunedin, because we hosted it in Dunedin. And about half of the participants who'd registered to be to the founding consultation meeting of the thing couldn't be at the meeting because they were held up in Christchurch Airport. And so before that, we had a bunch of open consultations, and this is part of what we do. Everything we do in terms of planning is done openly and transparently in the wiki as well. We had an open consultation. Paul, you were involved with, you know, some of that facilitation, and you did the report back at yes. that particular meeting.
Yeah.
And so we had the meeting, and great idea. We're going to assemble open online courses, and we're going to make these freely available. Partner institutions could charge for assessment services for building a model of transnational credit recognition. And that was the concept. And the folk in that meeting decided that we will call this thing the OER University, as in lowercase university, not referring to an institution, but a community of scholars, right? In the traditional sense of the meaning of university. On the eve of our official launch, which was in Kamloops, would have been 2013, Sir John Daniel was officiating. The evening before our official launch, I got a letter from Universities New Zealand challenging us with litigation for using the term university in our name. Now, they were perfectly correct. The Higher Education Act of New Zealand restricts the use of university to institutions that are registered universities. So we were technically breaking the law. But the reason it didn't come up at the international meeting is because the national legislations of the other partners wouldn't have had an impact. And then I knew we were onto something. Because if vice chancellors can spend time trying to litigate a small charity trying to widen access to learning, we were onto something. So anyway, I got our legal team on board and got, apparently a university bookstore is all right. You can have a university bookstore, but if you've got anything to do with learning, you can't call yourself a university. But I got legal consultation, and that is why we are the OER Universitas. it an elegant concept, right? You have partner institutions; they each contribute to courses. We, negotiate bilateral credit transfer agreements, and we set up the system. It's amazing. Little did I know that the hardest part of this exercise, I spent 7 years trying to negotiate transnational credit transfer. Because you put a vice chancellor, you put a registrar and legal counsel of two institutions in the same room, you have a long conversation. Yes. But that said, we do have a functioning model of transnational credit transfer. But, given what's happening around COVID and how higher education might evolve in a post-COVID world, I think we're going to have to, rethink strategic approaches in terms of what we do and how we do it. So that's kind of at the higher level concept area. But on the technology delivery side, we've done a bunch of interesting stuff, and that is where I think the real exciting stuff is going to happen. And so one of the things that we did of necessity, and if you just think of this in practical terms, we're a network of 40-plus institutions around the world. At the time we ran surveys, there would have been, we counted at least 15 different technical solutions for delivery of e-learning. The standard learning management systems and what have you. And there was no ways I was going to be brave enough to say, well, okay, at OERU, we're going to adopt learning management system X, because you will know how that story will pan out when you try to work collaboratively. And so then we intentionally designed a delivery system outside of a learning management system by design, but also to find practical solutions, because the institutions we are focused on helping are institutions in the developing world who don't have budget to run large, sophisticated learning management systems. And so we needed to figure out a solution for low-cost publication of open online courses, combined with solutions. I mean, we really, as an open organization, focused on collaborative development and editing. The whole issue of designing for remix and designing for reuse, which has very real implications for version control. And so if we had decided to use a learning management system, a Moodle or a Canvas or whatever, and I say to you, hey Paul, here's our a Moodle course, we're working together. Paul comes in, makes a couple of edits and changes. I have no idea what changes have been made. Now, the open source world have figured out, solutions for dealing with this through version control repositories, Git being the most widely used. But Git is not the kind of tool that the average educator is going to embrace. and start working with. And so the solution we adopted, for better or worse, was to author all content using a wiki. And we use the same software that powers Wikipedia, the MediaWiki software engine, and we edit courses collaboratively in a wiki environment. And then what we do is we have developed in-house a bunch of open source scripts that can harvest a snapshot image of a collection of wiki pages and publish them to a WordPress site. Now, WordPress is, I don't know what the latest figures are. Alan, you'd be better informed than what I am, but 60% of the web running on, you know,
a good chunk.
I mean, there are a lot of WordPress websites out there.
Yeah,
and so you know, it's a widely used technology, but it can be hosted at very, very low cost. Mm-hmm. I have an instance running now for a project we're working on providing, we've just run a course called Digital Skills for OER Sharing, which is about developing digital skills for school teachers to find OER, remix them, and develop printable teaching resources for use in the classroom. And we published this course on a dedicated WordPress multi-site instance for the project using a DigitalOcean droplet, which is $40 a month. Now, we had, there were 1,500 teachers that were registered and participating, active, a lot of engagement. We could delve into the performance metrics of the server, and it wasn't even using 1% of the capability of that server. And for, you know, so what this is about, for $40 a month, we can scale that delivery up for 10,000 learners. And that's the power of this stuff. Any organization can take and set up their own WordPress. You press a button and boom, you've got content sitting on your WordPress site. That's got version control on the back end. The other thing which we've done is we're trying to get back to the web that used to be. That place where we used to connect as a community and, you know, do stuff for the benefit of humanity. And we're trying to do that. And a key philosophy, I'm saying this tongue in cheek, but a key philosophy of what we're doing with our learners is we focus on building the digital literacies and digital fluencies of educators. There's some skills in life which, you know, appear to be trivial and easy to learn, but are in fact quite complex. I mean, things like learning to swim or learning to ride a push bike. You can't learn to swim by reading a book. You've kind of got to get your feet wet and do stuff, right? And similarly, if you want to learn how to learn on the internet, you can't learn to do that via a single application like a learning management system. And so what we've done is we've used a distributed ecosystem of interaction technologies for learners to engage and interact with each other. So for discussion forums, we use Discourse, which is the same technology that powers OE Global's Connect site. We use Mastodon as our social media platform, which you know is a federated free and open source system, which is not controlled by a single corporation. We can have multiple instances of Mastodon that can all speak with each other, and a learner never has to see an advertisement, doesn't have to see a feed that is determined by an algorithm, doesn't have to be baited into evil conversations. That Twitter is a bad place. And so we use Mastodon as a social media site. We use Moodle for people to submit assignments if they need to. We've got an interesting piece of, it's possibly the weakest link in our chain, a social media bookmarking technology. It's quite old, called Semantic Scuttle, which we've integrated. We also use the Hypothesis web annotation tool quite extensively for learners to annotate any web pages. And then the neat thing is, you know, again, an older technology, syndication, RSS and Atom feeds. We have the ability to generate course feeds, harvesting these interactions on these distributed technologies for a given course. So that's pretty cool. Now, those technologies, that is a suite of technologies, enable us to do some really exciting stuff. And that is to start thinking about federated open online courses, where you can have different institutions hosting the course content on their WordPress infrastructure, So, for example, we can have the OERU version of a course on our infrastructure. And then we could have, and we're working with an interesting experiment with OE Global because they're smart enough to see the future, delivering a professional development course hosted on your multi-site WordPress infrastructure. And because these interaction technologies can be distributed, conversations for an OE Global instance of a professional development course can be hosted on OE Global's instance of Discourse. If you wanted to, you could have spin up your own instance of Mastodon, which is not necessary, but you could if you wanted to. And then we can have these courses operating in parallel with each other, right? Mm-hmm. But this global community of learners can be in conversation with each other. And that is neat. And it's smart because it's doing something with open that you aren't going to do easily with closed. And I think those need to be the levers in which we engage with universities around integration of open in the curriculum. And this is, you know, we have an amazing group of partners within the network. And I suspect that 80% of the partners contribute to what we're doing out of a social justice agenda, because they know we're helping institutions in the developing world. So they're quite happy with, you know, giving a small bit of money to help keep this, you know, stuff going. But there's very little uptake at our partner institutions in actually reusing the courses that the network is putting together. And I, you know, in my former life as an accountant, I can hardly get my head around this, because if you can get an input that costs you nothing, that is of high quality, why wouldn't you use it? You know, you don't have to spend a cent on development costs. You're part of this network doing this, so you trust the people that are putting the stuff together, but you're not doing. Other institutions that are recognizing cross-credit don't advertise any of these content learning opportunities with their own learners. So learners that, for whatever reason, they're having to turn away because you know, they haven't got money to study, or you know, their life circumstances have changed, or they're not pointing those learners to the OERU stuff. So it's kind of a weird, you know, and I don't know what the reasons are behind all this, but it's just how the world operates. Yeah.
I was going to ask you what the reason was, because you set it up and to say, like, you know, why not? Is it lack of really completely understanding? Is it inertia within systems to...
So not invented here.
It's, yeah, you know, I think it's, you know, it's kind of all of the above, you know. You know, I mean, universities are having it hard at the moment, and particularly in our part of the world. I mean, Australasia, the majority of the research-led institutions have a heavy reliance on international student revenue. And with COVID lockdown, financially, these institutions are struggling. So, I mean, there are those challenges. So we do have a working model of transnational credit transfer at a micro course level. So we actually have a micro credentialing credit. So we have a working model so we can show people, look, this stuff works. But I don't think that is where we're going to get the biggest traction in the medium term over the next, you know, 4 to 5 years, given COVID, post-COVID challenges. Higher education is traditionally conservative. And I don't say that as a criticism. In fact, I think it's one of the reasons why universities have survived for so long. I mean, they're one of only a handful of organizations that survived the Industrial Revolution. And so that ultra-conservatism has contributed to the ongoing success of the university as concept. But by the same token, they're not always on sort of the cusp of cutting-edge innovation. And I kind of get the sense that a lot of the work that we are doing here is sort of 10 years against the sort of maturation for adoption within the university sector. So we need to fill the gap in the meantime, you know, doing things like prototypes of federated course delivery. So it's a much smaller vision for individual institutions to get their heads around, but incredibly valuable learning. I mean, how do you envision a world without learning management systems if you're not using other stuff? And it's hard to have that experience and that understanding. Yeah, yeah.
The recent project is, I understand, is working with Pacific Island nations. We don't hear much about them. So I'm wondering if you can share some like insights about what their interests and drives and challenges are and perspective on open education.
The Pacific region is a challenging region for obvious reasons. It's a region that is made up of thousands of small islands in very remote areas that have very expensive, if they have connectivity, it's very expensive. Very small populations, so it's hard to achieve economies of scale within the region. And so there are these unique challenges. It is also a very rich and diverse culture. And again, very little authentic Pacific content developed by Pacific Islanders is finding its way into the shared space in terms of OER. So there are many challenges. But these challenges are also strategic levers. So when the first lockdown occurred, working with OE Global, Commonwealth of Learning, we established the OER for COVID initiative, which was an attempt to say, well, okay, well, as a group of educators, let's get together to help and support each other. And we ran two or three thousand people that had engaged, but we ran a short little needs survey. What are your immediate needs around the space? And one of the things I thought would feature prominently would have been sharing open courses that are released as OER, because you don't have stuff. That would be a great solution. And surprisingly, that was not the highest ranked item. And in part, it could be related to issues around awareness. We actually don't know what this OER thing and all the, those big successful universities in the industrial world, they don't do that stuff. Why should we be doing it? And so there's a bit of that going on. But the two areas that ranked the highest were capacity development to improve digital skills in doing my own stuff, and the use of free and open source software tools to do it with. And so we've been, working on that emphasis. So one of the things we did, I managed and thankfully got funding support from the National Commission, the New Zealand National Commission for UNESCO, who funded, during the peak of the lockdown and the pandemic, a Big Blue Button instance for educators to be able to connect synchronously. And there was good uptake there. But, I deal with, governments across the Pacific. We've just signed up our Zoom license for I don't know how many thousands of dollars. And we're sitting thinking to ourselves, you don't have to be spending that money. In another instance, there was a Pacific Ministries website that was down because of certificate renewal. And the purchasing process to get the purchasing order to purchase the secure certificate was delayed. And we said, why aren't you using Let's Encrypt? You don't have to pay anything to get. So, there are many challenges, but there are also solutions. And I think if there's one place in the world we could achieve a cooperative solution to shared infrastructure, where we have technologists from different countries working together as a cooperative, hosting shared infrastructure across the Pacific region because of the small populations. So we can share at scale. We might get this right. So we're going to give it a shot and see what happens. And in fact, the digital skills for OER sharing course, we are in discussion now to have a Samoan instance running on a Samoan multi-site server install. So with the UNESCO Pacific Office, we're actually working with the Ministry of Education, Science and Culture in Samoa, who are establishing a lifelong learning lab. And part of the lifelong learning lab is some cloud-based infrastructure. And so the Samoan Ministry is hosting some, open infrastructure on tools, similar tool sets we're using, which means we can now just port this content into the Samoan context at the push of a button. So those are the things which I'm finding interesting. And, have a couple of good demonstrators out there. People will come and have a look-see, oh, you know, that doesn't look like my learning management system. you know, how does this work?
Paul or Marcel? I've been dominating because I like talking to Wayne.
Yeah, I do too.
Well, I love listening. Yes, actually, I am curious. This year we're celebrating the 10th year anniversary of the awards. And it's been exciting to look back and see how much the movement has grown and evolved since 2011 that the awards began. And you have been a longstanding supporter of open education. And I'm really curious to hear your opinion. What do you think is coming next? Or better yet, what would you like to see happening in the next 10 years? Because I don't know if we would have guessed 10 years ago that we would be where we are now.
It's a very good question. And to be fair, I'm not sure I know the answers because it's a very big question.
It's just a guess. I'll give you a magic wand and let's say that you will get your wish. What would that be?
Oh, I have a long wish list. You know, I've said this in other fora before. If I look and see the progress, and we have made good progress in open, to be fair, I couldn't have imagined us being so far down the track in terms of where we have got, you know, seeing the achievements compared to what we were looking at, you know, in the late 90s. But by the same token, we actually haven't achieved that much either. I mean, this is a big thing, you know, it's a slow burn model. It's going to take a while before we get it right. But I think the one challenge we are faced with is this notion, and I've said this in other fora, but I think it's important. The challenge we are faced now is to cross the chasm from sharing to learn to learning to share. Mm-hmm. Most educators, if you have a conversation, will agree about the value of sharing resources to support learning. I mean, after all, that's the essence of what we do as teachers, right? I mean, we're in this game to share knowledge. That's why we do it. But the bit in this puzzle we are not so good at doing is the actual sharing piece. Mm-hmm. We do not have a culture of sharing in higher education. Now, in part, that is related to reward systems because academics are rewarded for individual research output and on occasion, mm-hmm. you know, working together as a team. But we do not have this culture of sharing. And these are significant differences you'll see between open source software developers and educators. So if a free and open source software developer has to, develop a new app or a new feature or whatever, the very first thing they will go and do is they'll go and see what open code is out there that I can reuse. That is the first step. Dial back to the pandemic. The biggest crisis that higher education has ever faced in its entire history, I did not see much authentic collaboration on shared development of courses to address the challenge. We saw a lot of, hey, I'm collating this amazing list on how to survive remote teaching, and I'm happy to slap on a Creative Commons license.
Yeah.
Look, I'm sharing, but there was very little authentic cooperation and collaboration. And these are the real challenges we need to address. And we should be able to get it right. I mean, we are publicly funded, the majority of us are public funded institutions. We are doing this work for public good. We should be collaborating better. And that's kind of the stuff that I spend my nights, lying awake is, how do we facilitate this cooperation and collaboration? And the most effective way we've found so far, and I'm not suggesting this is the solution, is just because we don't have money. We're a small organization. We just do it. Now, we get out there into the trenches, and by hook or by crook, we force cooperation. Mm-hmm. And it's a slow process, but we are slowly getting, some interesting runs on the board where, institutions are actually reusing, and they're not hundreds and thousands, it's a handful, but are actually reusing OERU open courses locally for teaching their own students locally and learning through that process and experiencing the benefits. So I'm not sure that's a solution for the future, but I think it would be a productive area in improving what we do. I mean, there's been a lot of talk, and I'm not criticizing the open textbook movement at all. I mean, there's been a lot of talk around open textbooks. And amazing stuff has been done in terms of generating savings for students and, you know, getting the conversation going in institutions and what have you. But at the individual level of the academic or faculty member, adopting an open textbook implies very little change. I'm taking this textbook and I'm replacing it with that textbook. I'm not changing any of my practice. It's an easy win. The bit where academic from Pacific works together with academic from Canada in developing the shared output, there's very little of that happening. And I reckon that's where we need to focus our efforts. We get that right. Because, you see, that again is that, you know, the key point of difference, because it's hard to do that with closed. You can't have two corporate companies who are competing with each other doing that kind of cooperation and collaboration. It's just not in the DNA to do that. And, you know, again, you know, leveraging the things we can do with open that we can't do with closed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you take on major, huge challenges with everything. So I don't know. I'm just like this. Like I'm curious. Like when you get frustrated or feel like, you know, or those when you're up at night. Like what is it that kind of refuels you or you know gets you forward thinking again and not saying like this is a challenge.
I mean, I think in my personal case, the driver is, you know, I just have a deep, abiding love and passion for education and helping learners. And the majority of my work is, I'm in the trenches. I'm developing content. I'm doing the stuff that's helping individuals and, you know, people. And I guess that's sort of the reward mechanism. You know, you're doing these small things, but that are helping real lives, right? And that's the reward, because you can see this little intervention you've had here with this person who couldn't figure out why the password on another system is not working on another system with, you know, and you help them out and they're away and they complete a course. That stuff is meaningful. And that's the stuff that keeps me going. The big strategic stuff is interesting, but you know, years of strategic high level consultation, and you know, 2 years later, you might get a bullet point on a Senate meeting, and you know. Trouble is, retirement is coming, right? I've got to make a difference before I retire, so you've got to work with the things where you get, you know, real outputs. And where we are getting real traction, and it's not surprising, one of our most successful initiatives is the OERU Outreach Partnership Initiative. And that is an initiative where we provide free membership of accredited tertiary education institutions in the developing world who don't have money to join the network. It's not very good for fiscal sustainability. Yeah. It's very good at helping institutions really, because we have a memorandum of understanding and the vice chancellor signs we do not have money to be part of this thing, and we say that's fine, let's, you know, walk this journey together. And that is our biggest growth area, is the outreach partnership. And that coupled with, and this will be of particular interest to OEG, professional development of educators. Our most popular courses are the ones where educators are improving their capabilities.
It's always so great listening to you, Wayne, because you can see why you were given this award. You're so thoughtful and your commitment is so evident. And so, I mean, I just want to say thanks, because I've known you for a very long time and you continue to be an inspiration for me. So thanks for everything you've done.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very kind. And similarly, I mean, the work that you guys are doing, you know, that's why we continue. You know, working together, we can shift mountains, right? And that's the exciting part of this work, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for taking a bit of your Cromwell morning, Wayne. to listen to us. It's always enjoyable, and we hope we can have more of these connections, which we will. And thank you out there for listening to this episode of OEG Voices. This is our podcast at Open Education Global. And when this gets edited, you might start to hear the beginning in the background of some music kicking in. It's a track called Joyful Meeting by an artist named Crowwander, found in the Free Music Archive. my first place to go often for looking for music is just licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial. And you'll find this episode at our site, voices.oeglobal.org. And we hope you engage and follow up with Wayne in our OEG Connect environment, which you already mentioned, which is connect.oeglobal.org. And so anybody out there who wants to share their open education work or let us know someone we should bring into the conversations here, please let us know. And thanks again. We just really appreciate these opportunities, Wayne, Marcel, and Paul, just to like take a break from the work schedule and just sit here and have a conversation. It's very rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Alan. And as always, great to be able to connect, and let's continue doing great things together. Yeah.